The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome to this August 21st, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, also Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website is penonfire.com. My website is mariestone.com, mariestone.com. And coincidentally, I'm your host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. This morning is all short stories all the time. And I'm sure if you are any sort of a listener, you would know this by now that I'm a huge fan of the short story form. And it's kind of been a while since I've done a collection on the show. So this week felt a little bit like a creative oxygen to me coming back to that. Peter Orner is with me now after 8 long years, and coming up in the second half hour, Ben Marcus will be here with his latest terrific collection, now in paperback, Notes from the Fog. Peter Orner is a 2-time winner of the Pushcart Prize. He is the author of 2 novels, The Second Coming of Mavala Shikango and Love and Shame and Love, and 2 short story collections, Esther Stories and Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge. His memoir, Am I Alone Here?, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Peter's fiction and nonfiction have appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, Granta, the Paris Review, on and on, many other publications. He has been my guest on 2 other occasions, way back in 2007 and again in 2011. You can find those podcasts up on my website. But it is his latest collection, Maggie Brown and Others, published by Little Brown, that we're talking about this morning. Peter, welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Marie. Thanks for having me.
Good to be back. Thanks for coming back on. So you just wrote a brief, you said perhaps a little inebriated, I don't know if that's true or not, which I love, rant, you said, in the Paris Review, sort of in defense of the short story. And so kind of tell us what set you off and where the short story is and perhaps should be.
Sure. I'm often asked, as I'm sure anybody who writes short stories is, or not asked, but told, that what a great thing that you write stories, because it's we're such a distracted society and people have very little time, and what a great form, it fits in so well with like who we are today. And this makes me
crazy.
Apoplectic, to say the least. Where to begin, except to say that that I think any good piece of writing takes intense concentration, and that really has nothing to do with, I mean, being distracted and living in a very distracted environment doesn't help short story writers.
Right.
To say the least.
Right, right. It's sort of like saying, isn't it great that we can read poetry, because in the time of Twitter, we can, you can read Twitter and poetry in the same mental breath,
and,
right?
Yeah. Exactly. And it's not that there isn't great poetry on Twitter. It's just that, to read great poetry, it whatever the delivery system, it takes some calm concentration, slowing way down, not in the ways that I think that, and I'm very guilty of this as well, but reading stuff online too fast and not really feeling it. And, literature is about feeling it. And so I think we're in great danger, but I think that reading stories, you gotta bring attention to it. Otherwise, forget about it.
Yeah, yeah. And yet, since we talked last time, I feel like the short story, it used to kind of be the ugly stepchild to the novel for a while there. And it seems to be enjoying sort of a really nice renaissance. And, I see so many more short story collections out there than I did 10 or 15 years ago. And it really gave me a lot of hope, because I'm such a fanatic for the form.
Well, I mean, and I appreciate that and other short story writers. Ben, you got Ben Marcus coming, who's a wonderful story writer and incredibly innovative with the form. So, we all appreciate that you're out there reading us. But, I think that it's always been a renaissance for the short story. It's just that people, the spotlight comes in and out on it, which I think is appropriate because I think there's something kind of stealth about stories. Mm-hmm. I think they kind of, they speak from the corners. They're not, in my view, trying to, explain the whole world to you, but rather explain a moment, which I find infinitely complex. That's why I'm drawn to them.
Yeah.
So I feel like, especially in our society, there's all, in every era of American life, there's always been story writers kind of, again, speaking from sort of a different angle than certain novelists who might be portend to speak for, a greater swath of society. Does right. that make any sense?
It does. Yeah, it does. It does. So to turn to this collection a little bit, so the collection consists
sure.
of 43 short stories and a novella. I love that we're returning back to Walt and Sarah. We'll get to them in a moment, but we've seen them before.
Oh, thanks.
And even the novella is made up of like 30 kind of vignettes, chapters, sections. I don't know what you want to talk about.
Right.
But the 43 short stories are generally kind of divided into these five sections that loosely address kind of geography and across time. How am I doing introducing this?
The problem with talking about a story collection is because there's so many things going on and so many different characters, it's hard, but
right.
I get it. I mean, I get how difficult that is, but you're doing great. You're doing totally great. Thank you.
I guess the question here is A, you can kind of talk about it better than I can, but kind of take us into your head about what's been on your mind the last, I think some of these stories have been written over, you said one of them was started way back in 1999.
I know, Walt
and Sarah, you've been with for years and years. But kind of what has been on your mind either thematically or human conditionally as you were putting the collection together? It's a hard question, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I've had similar preoccupations since I started doing this. And I guess I realized with this book is that it was okay to revisit, in some cases, the same stories or revisit stories that I couldn't get right and were working on that sort of haunted me for whatever reason that I couldn't quite say. And I had a year off. I was living in Africa. I suddenly had all my papers with me, and I was able to go back and look at things that hadn't worked, but that I carried around with me,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the story that, I started in 1999. That's a story called An Ineffectual Tribute to Len. And in that particular story, I felt like I wanted to write this story, and I had notes for it, and I had thoughts on it for years, but I couldn't quite sort of figure out what I wanted to say. And, it took 25 years or something like that. But I had a swath of time, which really helped. But I had all these memories that weren't developed, and that I had time to think about them.
Right, right. It's interesting that...
Memory is the big thing. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, memory is a big... Yes, right, right. We're going to get to that in a...
Sure.
In a moment with one of these short stories that I think sort of set the stage for the whole collection as a whole. But anyway, I was really interested in you working on the collection from a distance because when I read it, I mean, geographically, it's an American collection. It feels very American.
Sorry.
No worries. No worries.
I'm a volunteer firefighter. My pager just went off, but I'm sure
you are.
It's fine.
Oh my god! Oh, oh, geez.
Yeah, I think it's not my department, so no worries.
Oh boy. Okay, I don't want to be the cause of anybody's fire here.
No, fine.
So it was interesting to me that you've written obviously across a lot of geography. You know, your attention was turned to Africa for a while. This collection really felt very kind of distinctly American to me. I mean, most of the stories were set in the U.S., but still otherwise kind of distinctly American in other ways. And I was thinking about you working on the collection from Africa, and if that distance and perspective kind of helped you see these stories maybe through a different lens because you weren't here. Is that making any sense?
Totally, and it's absolutely true. I was in Namibia in southern Africa where I lived in the 90s, and my first novel was set there. I went back. I wanted to bring my family back and, you know, kind of show them where I'd lived. And I was on a Fulbright and doing research for a historical book that I'm also working on set in Namibia. But, you know, I think when you're distant and away from home, especially in 2016 with the chaos going on back here, I don't know, I felt a certain sense of, like you say, distance, almost a little bit of calm that I could just sort of exist without being so enraged by politics as to be distracted, which I think is very possible. It's certainly where I'm at the moment, for example.
Right.
But I was able to, you know, Namibia is a kind of it's a beautiful and fairly quiet place, and I was able to sort of concentrate in ways that I hadn't been able to do in many years. And I think for sure the distance, and this always plays out with me, where I write about place from another place. I have to leave. I lived in California for many, many years, 15 years or more than that, and I'd never written about California. I'd never felt Californian. I've always felt myself a Chicagoan that's out of place. But, you know, leaving California, suddenly I felt, all right, you know, that I miss the, you know, California spring, which is so the light in April and May on the coast where I used to live in West Marin. I just was haunted by it. So, you know, I think you bring places with you where you end up, and then I tend to write back. I try and get back by writing.
Yeah. I don't know if you can give language to my sort of amorphous feeling about this being distinctly American aside from just it taking place in the U.S., but it did. It just felt like it couldn't have been set psychologically, aside from the geography, it couldn't have been set in a different country, that these were somehow characters who had American values, or they were distinctly steeped in our culture, which it's hard for me to even say what that is because I've never really lived away from it. As you say, it's easier to kind of see it when you're apart from it, and I never really have been. But do you feel that way? Do you feel like there's something very distinctly American about these stories that separate and apart from just, you know, setting?
I do, and I'd have trouble articulating it too. You know, people have said this, you know, that like Europeans have sometimes trouble understanding where I'm coming from. You know, I think I am sort of radiating out from the Midwest and having my own kind of examination of what it's like to be an American in a particular place. And this book, you know, has the Midwest, it has California, and also has where my mother grew up and where my grandparents lived and died in Fall River, Massachusetts, which you mentioned earlier, the Kaplan. So for me, you know, it's dealing with characters who can't be separated from the place that they're from. I think that has a lot to do with it. No matter where you are, I mean, I'm Chicagoan, no matter where I go,
yeah.
I feel like it. I sort of bring that, whatever sensibility that is, which, you know, can't be categorized, even though we try. So I hear you, and I feel like it, you know, I'm trying to say something about what it's like to be from these places.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Kaplans a little bit, because obviously they've stayed in your head over the years. And you said even this novella you had been working on, I guess maybe separate and apart from the other ways you've been writing about the Kaplans for 10 years. And maybe you can just talk about what these people are to you, what they represent, why they've dug in so deep. They've dug in deeply to all of us, and I can guess from my own point of view why they're so compelling. But for you, what makes you continue to return to them?
Well, thank you. I mean, I've often felt like, especially when I was working on this, I'm like, really, again, you can't come up with any different characters, right? But I feel like I felt like that was okay. I kind of gave myself permission to revisit a couple who I'd spent a lot of time with in my first book, and periodically they sort of appear in almost every one in a peripheral way sometimes, and sometimes not even a direct way. In the Africa book, Second Coming of Mount of Chicago, there is a Walt Kaplan character. He's just not named Walt Kaplan. Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly interested in a guy and a woman based on, roughly on my grandparents who lived their whole lives in a downtrodden industrial city in Massachusetts, which has seen better days. Used to be the textile capital of the world, and then that ended abruptly in about the 1880s, 1890s, and Fall River's never quite recovered. And yet, my grandparents, who lived into the 80s and 90s, lived there. And my grandfather, in particular, had a great affection for the city. And he was sort of when he died, I inherited all of his books, which many of them had to do with the history of Fall River, and also I have probably 45 or 50 Fall River directories, which are hardcover phone books.
Oh, wow.
stretching from about the 19-teens to all the way, you know, into the 60s, 70s. They're enormous. They're big books, and they're heavy. And these are my sort of cherished possessions. And I sometimes just read them, and I'm like, oh, you know, so-and-so was a seamstress on Mabel Lane in 1962. Interesting, you know. And I just have these. And these Fall River directories are not just phone numbers, but they actually give, like I said, they give the occupation, and they give the who the person is married to, if they're widowed, if they're, et cetera, and then it gives the address. And it's just incredible wealth of information. And I always wonder, like, what was my grandfather doing collecting these? And I've always thought, that he was sort of collecting souls, if that makes any sense. That he was just fascinated by all the people that had lived in his particular, small town in Massachusetts.
It's like,
and so these people... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's so wonderful. I was just, for some reason, as you're saying all this, Spoon River Anthology just pops up in my head of, this this place where people are so deeply rooted and just stay and die in all their little stories. And I think you had talked about in the second section this idea of, if you just walk down a street and you see all the lights in the windows and you imagine all of the lives and all of the suffering and all the heartache, and everybody's stories behind these lit up windows. And as you're describing this awesome book, it's kind of the same thing, right? That you just go scroll down the names and everyone is this, it's just a line of text, and it's representative of this massive story that lies behind it of people's lives and occupations and all that stuff.
Right. And I'd also say joy behind those windows. And that to me, what you're saying, what you're describing, seems to me like a story collection. Definitely a story collection that I was trying to make, which was sort of tried to replicate that feeling of being, of walking down a sidewalk, looking up at a building, a moderate-sized apartment building in some medium-sized city in America, and trying to imagine what's going on in each apartment, which. Those are disconnected stories, and that's what I really love about a collection in general, and that's what I was trying to do here with just kind of trying to examine, each window.
Yeah,
And then at the end, it's this, I did want to look at what a happy marriage would be like,
yeah.
And that I really wanted to try that because they exist, and they're beautiful, and they're not perfect, and that's what I was trying to get at with the Kaplans.
The Kaplans sort of remind me of, I don't know if you read the Stuart Onan books about, and Henry himself is the most recent one, but, he's returned to this family over and over, and then he gives kind of a novel to each individual member of the family. And they're a quiet, happily married Midwestern couple that nothing terribly overwhelmingly interesting happens to, and they're so compelling.
Right.
They're just so
right,
fully realized. You don't need a lot of drama on the page to make people's heart bleed for these guys. I mean, they're just...
No, you don't. And we got them, we got it in our own families, and we know what that's like. And I sometimes feel like, why gin things up? And what about you know, a real serious study of what, you know, may not be incredibly dramatic, but may be incredibly moving. And I find Onan's books absolutely in that category. And he's a wonderful writer. And so, you know, it's not that common, I think,
right.
To read about people where they aren't in, massive crisis. Although I should say, you know, while Kaplan is in a pretty serious crisis throughout the novella, but in his own kind of muted way. But it, you know, he's in crisis for sure. But it isn't. I would say it's not as outwardly dramatic. Partly because he's hiding it. You know, it has to do with him being depressed in a very serious way, and what he's trying to do about that. Which is a sad and not easy thing. But he makes it somehow.
Right. So great. You know what I love about this collection also is that you can be very, your stories, a lot of them are very, very short, page, 2 pages, 3 pages. So you're very distilled and concise, and, the stories are just tiny little tight gems. And yet because they talk across each other and they feel like they're in dialogue with each other, it also feels very expansive and fully realized. So this, as you're talking about trying to create this sensation of walking down a street and looking up at all of these lit up windows, you get the best of both worlds. You get this tightness, compression of, you know, like poetic gems, but then you also get the pleasure of feeling like you're in this whole world occupied by a bunch of different people that are, you know, all kind of, if not directly talking to each other, kind of at least ringing against each other, and that's a great part of this form.
Well, I absolutely appreciate it, and thank God you're a story reader, because some people feel jarred and feel like, oh wait, I wanted to spend more time with those people, and I get that, and that's a fair criticism. I think I sort of, I guess with this time around, I just wanted to own it. This is what I'm interested in doing, which is trying to do a deep dive, but then trying to take a step back and realizing next to that one window there's another window. And it's just like, I almost felt overwhelmed by the amount of characters for me I was working with, but that became the disadvantage, or whatever I wasn't good at became what I was actually trying to work at.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
My
Achilles heel, which may be that I sometimes write too short, I wanted to try and make that an advantage.
Yes, right. Symbolically, the whole collection ends on the punctuation mark and M dash, and actually a couple of the stories also end on a punctuation, the M dash. And I just thought that was a great metaphor for kind of the collection in general, you know, that everything is kind of to be continued. You know, the M dash sort of creates this white space in the reader's head. Like, well, the story's going on, and you know, you're going to have to kind of fill in the blanks. And I thought, you know, what a great. I just love the M dash in general, but I've never ended on one.
I do too. I Emily Dickinson. I mean, right? I mean, she taught us like what the power of that was. There is a story in here. I was just checking to make sure it actually made it in the final version, but that I was arguing with my wonderful editor at Little Brown, Ben George, but he would often put in a punctuation mark where I didn't want one, and it was the end of a story called Montreal,
yes.
And I wanted it to end without any. It ends up with please see.
Please, oh please,
and,
yes.
And then it just sort of just goes into white space, and you know, I wanted that. I wanted that drop off without any full stop, because it was continuing, like you said. You know, I really wanted to work with that. The M dash does that too. Like, it doesn't end. But I wanted something even more than that for that story. But I think you can experiment with punctuation, because punctuation really is very much a part of the story. You know, a period stops something, but not having one, that sends another message.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that was going to be my next one. Is there's even a story in here without any punctuation at the end at all. It's so great.
I don't know if you can hear the thunder here. There's a major, I mean, my office at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, and there's like thunder and lightning, and it's a very dramatic storm going on outside.
And so apparently a fire. So
the phone. Right, fires, and it could be, it's probably a tree down on a wire.
So, it's the end of times.
Another town, not our town.
Yikes. I love that you're a volunteer firefighter. I had no idea that was. I had no idea. That's good. A great another texture.
Yeah, right. Something I started doing in California in West Marin, and I picked up doing it here in the small town of Vermont that I live in, and I love it. I'm still very much a rookie, even after doing it a few years, but I do love it.
That's really great. That's really great. We're running out of time. I had wanted to take the first story in the collection. It's very short. I don't know if we have time to read it, but why don't you go ahead? Why don't you read the first story in the collection? Because I think it's both concise, it's allegorical, it's metaphorical, and I went back with the exercise of sort of viewing the rest of the collection through the prism of some of the issues that this story brings up about memory and other things. I'll let you read it first, and then I guess we can talk for a minute about it. So the story is called
When
The Deer.
When she was a kid. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the story is called The Deer, and I'll let you go.
Great. When she was a kid, she watched a mountain lion chase a deer into the lagoon at low tide. She'd been riding her bike on the path along the edge of Murch's farm. The deer ran out so far into the water that the mountain lion turned back to the shore and vanished into the trees. An hour later, the deer was still stuck in the mud. The tide began to roll back in through the channel connecting the lagoon to open water. She was only a kid, but as she watched the deer out there alone, she knew almost right away that this was something she'd carry the rest of her life. Later, she heard that a tourist, seeing the deer in the lagoon from Highway 1, had called the fire department and begged them to do something. The assistant chief said, "What do you want me to do about it? Go out there with a boat and get kicked in the head? Call the DNR." The lagoon, the waves, the motionless deer. It made no sound, or at least none that she could hear from where she was sitting, as it waited, or seemed to wait, while the water rose, covering its legs, and then rising higher. She'd sat on a wet log and watched. The damp seeped through her pants. The wind blew inland from the ocean. No, it wasn't really happening. Even then, it was more like an image, fixed, not a breathing deer out there in the water. So much of what she remembers becomes lodged this way. Something occurs in the motion of the present, but it's already over. Because even then, as she watched, she was already moving away from it, already thinking about how years from now she would tell someone about this, someone who's never seen this lagoon. The wind began to blow harder. The sun had long since fallen, but there was some light left. And when she couldn't watch anymore, when she picked her bike up off the ground and rode away, the water had reached the deer's chest, and still it had not moved.
I love that story so much. So the story is called The Deer. It's the first in the collection. And to me, it really just kind of set the stage, as you say, about memory, about even then it was more like an image fixed, and so much about what she remembers has been lodged this way. And then, as you know, as I just read the rest of the stories, they all, you know, to set up this kind of allegory of how we experience things in the aftermath, how we would tell the story of what happened to us, and how things kind of seem fixed in time. It just became a really great way to look at the rest of the stories in the collection. And I don't know if that was, I mean, everything you do is intentional, so I'm sure that was intentional, but talk a little bit about that, setting that as the first anchor story for the rest of the book.
Well, I think, like you said, that this idea, and I think we all experience this, right? When you kind of have a out-of-body experience in the moment where you know you're going to remember this one,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I've just been thinking about that idea for a long time, and I hadn't quite sort of thought about how to articulate it, or at least try, because I think stories are just attempts. They're not articulations that are full-on explanations. But something like this did happen out in West Marin, and I did see it myself. And I think what I tried to do is I tried to imagine my daughter seeing it, my 9-year-old, on her bike. Mm-hmm. I was thinking what it would be like for a kid, especially, you know, a kid who's sensitive and would be very devastated for that deer, but at the same time kind of having the maturity to know that, A, there's probably nothing she could have done about it, and B, she's going to remember it. Yeah. And I kind of went from there.
So great. Well, I could talk to you for 1,000 years, but we're out of time, and it's killing me. It's killing me slowly.
Likewise.
So we can find you online. I don't know if are you doing a book tour where we can find you, or are you?
I've been in San Francisco, LA, all over. Sort of done the book tour, but I'm going to be back around in the Midwest in September, October, and I'll be back in California in the November and the spring again too.
Good.
Bay Area stuff.
Okay.
But I'm a big fan of, I'm a big fan of the UC Irvine program, and have a lot of friends over there. So hello to those guys if anyone's listening.
Thank you. Peter Orner, it's always so great to talk to you. I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Marie. Likewise.
Thank you. We're going to take a very short break. Ben Marcus will be with me in the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. We are on iTunes. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Ben Marcus is the author of 5 books of fiction, The Age of Wire and String, Notable American Women, The Flame Alphabet, Leaving the Sea, and Notes from the Fog. He's the editor of the anchor book of the New American Short Stories, The New American Stories. Since 2000, he has taught on the faculty of Columbia University School of Arts. Notes from the Fog was released in paperback last month. It's published by Vintage, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Ben, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Oh, I don't know how I missed this when it originally came out last year, because it's totally up my alley. But, God, I love this collection. So the New York Times likened this to Black Mirror. I don't know how you feel about that comparison, but I guess if you were trying to do a 2-word summary, you know, it's not a terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind it. I think Black Mirror at its best produces these really uncanny experiences, grounded in reality a little bit, but pushed into strange places. So I was flattered.
Yeah. No, it's not a terrible description. It certainly would make, a whole host of people like me immediately grab the book. So it's kind of hard to wrap the wonderful collection up in a good summary. But there's a story in here called The Grow Light Blues that I think is where you said the book sort of began for you. It kind of became, correct me if I'm wrong, but it kind of became the foundation upon which the rest of the stories could be built. So I thought maybe we could start there with kind of what was on your mind for that story, and then kind of how the collection may have formed around it. I sort of think of this as, you know, that first kernel, and then things kind of grow around it.
Yeah. Well, The Grow Light Blues is about a guy who works at a sort of mysterious corporation that is sort of modeled on tech culture, companies trying to disrupt, trying to kind of invent things that suddenly we can't live without, and they're trying to invent a new way to eat, and they come up with a grow light, the idea that plants can eat from light, so why not people? And so they decide that they should test this through computer displays so that we can just sit at our displays and eat and not waste time. I read that Elon Musk had said, when talking about productivity and how to get the most out of your day, that he regarded eating as what he called a pain point. In other words, you know, you have to eat, but it takes up so much time. And I thought, well, that first of all, that's so opposite how I would ever think about eating, which is kind of one of my favorite things in life, and it's also about being with people. So I thought that there was something really upsetting, but reflected in that idea that also showed how, I guess, technological culture works. And so my protagonist ends up volunteering for this experiment to try to eat through his, try to feed through his computer display, and it really doesn't go well. And I guess that story just opened up a territory for me that was interesting, this sort of desperation we have to improve ourselves, to make progress, to invent new things, and how that can, I think, sort of erase who we are a little bit. I don't think it has to, but I think it often does. And so that was, I guess, something that seemed exciting and worth exploring to me, and something that then I picked up in more stories, and you know, the collection started to kind of form around that a little bit with some variations.
That's such a perfect Elon Musk thing to say. Like, that just seems like...
Yeah, right? And you know, there's this product, Soylent, which was invented... It's a meal shake, right? You can just drink your meal and 10 seconds at your desk and be guaranteed you'll have all the nutrition you need. And, of course, it tastes like, you know, algae and chalk or whatever, and it's... You don't get any of the pleasure out of food, and there's this funny way that people seem so ready to discount all the ways we connect over food, and so I don't know. I'm drawn into it and kind of intrigued by it, but also scared of it. And I think to me, then that makes it worth exploring in fiction.
Well, and it's just so perfect for our times. I mean, this is a collection that obviously I don't think could have been written, 25 or 30 years ago. I mean, it raises all these issues of whether human nature is really immutable and fixed, regardless of all the technological changes that we're enduring and how our brains are sort of bending around what keeps happening to us.
Yeah, I mean, there are all these fantasies that technology is going to deliver us from everything, right? Yeah. And there's a sort of immortality fantasy. There's the post-apocalyptic survival fantasy. You've got these people building these underground bunkers in New Zealand and people freezing their bodies or trying to, digitally upload their brains. And so, part of it is really just a survival instinct, and it makes perfect sense. But it's there's still a human story to that striving, I think. There's still a story to be told about what happens to us when we try to kind of exceed our boundaries.
Right, right. There's also sort of, I feel like everybody has this investment in feeling like they're living through the end of times. And, there's this kind of apocalyptic feeling to maybe every generation goes through this, but it feels like that again. And that really felt like it was permeating a lot of these stories that, if this isn't the end of times, it'll do till the end of times gets here. Right.
Yeah. And, what you said resonates for me because, who wants to think that they're just living in some unremarkable period of history? It seems that we have to, in some ways, believe that the time when we are alive is sort of extraordinary and special and kind of unprecedented, maybe. To believe otherwise is sort of sad in a way. But it also makes us kind of stretch our imaginations in different ways or overreact and become paranoid. And all of these things, to me, are the fodder of fiction, I think, right? Like, to me, fiction wrestles with who we are and how we try to maintain our identities with all of these challenges coming from, the political spectrum, the ecological spectrum, social spectrum.
Right. I was going to say there's no fear of us feeling like we're not living in some remarkable time right now. So lucky us.
No. Yeah, that's right. It would be really interesting if there was someone out there saying, hey, everybody, this is all really normal. This has happened 1,000 times before.
Right.
Well, you just don't hear that. You don't hear that out in the punditry class.
You do not. You do not. I love, I felt like if you went through these stories and just looked at your word choices, like just looked at the nouns and verbs that you use, you build such amazingly complicated worlds that... they're all familiar, but they're also, like just kind of to the left of our world, but not very far. And like you had this phrase about the pelvic frost settled down. I'm like, I don't even know what that means, but it evokes such a feeling of dread. And,
yeah, I think that's meant to describe like a kind of decline of intimacy in a marriage. And
I don't know.
You know, I don't exactly have a clue to where those things come up with, but I come from. But I do come up with a lot of bad ones that I have to get rid of later. And I like to try to characterize things in some succinct way that still feels it. Still might evoke something, but it's I don't know. There's not really a roadmap for that.
Well, it's a gift. Whatever you're doing, you really got to embrace that because it's. The stories are as much felt as they are read. You know, like I feel like they might be hard to turn into. They're more visceral than they are visual. And, you know, they sort of seep in. I mean, the fog is really a great metaphor, this Notes from the Fog. I mean, the collection not only deals with a lot of fog and mist and things seeping into you, but that's literally how the stories feel when you're reading them, is that it's the kind of this fog that's seeping into your head as you're reading it. And, it's experiential as much to, anyway, I don't know how
I guess that reflects a little like what I like to feel when I read. You know, I remember, you know, being a kid and reading and just feeling completely engrossed, right? Like I wouldn't hear someone talk to me and I didn't want to go out and play. And I just would be really wrapped up in a book, but that's harder and harder to find. I think, you know, our attention is, we know it's damaged. Our attention spans are damaged and lots of stuff is going on. And I have a job and I have a family, and it's harder and harder for me to really become wrapped up in a book completely. And I think sometimes when I write, it's a way at least to try to just be immersed as wholly as I can in something. And, you know, so in some sense I'm trying to write something I'd want to read, which isn't always easy to do and maybe isn't always a good idea, but it's a way to connect to how that felt when I read as a kid.
Right, right. Even Notes from the Fog is sort of reminiscent. I mean, you can't read that without sort of thinking of Notes from the Underground, because it's just, you know, cadence-wise in your
That's
head.
True.
And it feels like the modern version of that, you know, that...
Oh, that's very nice of you to say. I love that. I love that story or novella, book, whatever. You know, yeah, I mean, Dostoevsky was hugely important to me. And in fact, I had a long period of time where, you know, I would read like Crime and Punishment again and just think, well, why bother writing? It's just pointless. And, you know, I think I probably would still feel that now I'm smart enough to not reread it, because it's so disabling to read him. It feels so complete, the way he renders the world and the psychic struggles of being in the world, along with the joy of it, but also the challenge and the difficulty of it. You know, it's hard to think of anyone who's done that more deeply than him.
Yeah, yeah. However, I mean, this really evoked the same sort of feeling of isolation and loneliness and the breakdown of human relationships in a more modern twist, you know, now that we're consumed by iPhones and online worlds and what that's doing to our marriages and our relationships with our kids. And, you know, you're the Dostoevsky of the 21st century. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you. That's a lot of pressure.
I know. Don't you? Well, you better live up. I heard in another interview you talking about this really interesting idea that I hadn't come across before, which is Saunders, which you can describe it better than I can, but I think it's kind of an interesting creative idea.
The phrase is saunter, and it's a feeling you have when you look at someone. Let's say you're walking down the street and you look at a stranger and are overwhelmed with the feeling of their separate life, that it could be filled with sorrow and struggle and joy and just this life that you won't ever really know. You know, we have to accustom ourselves to kind of passing strangers all the time and can't really devote our emotional energy to a, you know, sort of deeply empathic sort of mental excursions about who they really are and what they really feel. But I forget who turned me on to that phrase, but it's very affecting, because every now and then you can almost be brought to your knees by just kind of the sheer fact of another identity that's outside of you that you won't ever really be able to access. And I suppose it's probably a healthy thing to indulge in because it helps you realize that, well, first of all, the world doesn't revolve around you and that there's pain and suffering and sorrow and happiness orbiting around you to a degree that you kind of can't even fathom.
Well, it's interesting that you brought that word sort of came up because in the first half hour, Peter Orner was on and we were talking about this idea of a collection of stories being like walking down a street and looking up at, you know, a big apartment complex with all these lit up windows and imagining each one of what each one of those lit up windows represents, and that you can do that in a short story collection that you can't quite do in a novel, but it allows you to, just look at one slice of some stranger out there and the vast world that exists, the vast emotional psychological world that exists behind that person. And, I don't know, those two ideas, this Sonder and this idea of the lit up apartment windows as a way to get into story seemed resonant between the two of you. And I just thought that was...
Oh, well, I love his work and I love that image, that metaphor for what the writer is trying to do. And I think it's very telling. I think empathy is a probably an underdeveloped muscle in a lot of people, or just a sort of an attempt to understand things from different perspectives. I mean, we don't really see it very much in this country politically, and it's I think endlessly rewarding when you can read a writer who makes a practice of that, who can inhabit other lives, other identities, and make them feel real. And I don't know, it just feels incredibly enriching, and I feel lucky that we get to have that kind of artistic experience, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it can feel so complete and so persuasive.
Right, right. Oh, it kills me. We're drawing down on our time. Do you have any last-minute words of wisdom or advice for writers?
Advice for writers. I need advice. I need someone to help me write. I think the advice is probably that your best audience is yourself, and that if you can write to really deeply challenge and please and entertain yourself, it might be a better strategy than guessing what other people might like and trying to cater to that. And then you can hope that in entertaining yourself in some way, you might be automatically entertaining others. On the other hand, maybe that's terrible advice. Maybe it's smarter to just be more calculated. I think I go back and forth on that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I wish we had more time, but this was wonderful. Thank you so, so much.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on.
This is great. That was Ben Marcus. The book Notes from the Fog is available now in paperback at all your favorite indie bookstores and elsewhere, but let's support our indie bookstores. That's all the time we have for this week. Barbara will be on next week with T. Jefferson Parker and Sigrid Nunez. In the meantime, stay tuned for Rock Coaster. Some great tunes coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.